Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, August 23rd, 2017. Donald Trump unhinged. That was the Trump who showed up in Phoenix, Arizona last night, the unpresidential Donald Trump.
I see all those red hats and white hats. It's all happening very fast. It's called Make America Great Again. You see what's going on.
At the podium, there was a black man who stood behind Trump in a sea of white faces wearing a T-shirt which read, Trump and Republicans are not racist. Other signs, Women for Trump, Pence, Make America Strong Again, Make America Proud Again, Make America Great Again, and even Drain the Swamp.
In Charlottesville, strikes at the core.
In typical campaign mode, as if he was running for office, Trump played the crowd and took swings at one of his favorite punching bags, the media. In defense of his comments regarding Charlottesville, Trump reframes his comments as if he said nothing wrong when he equated protesters with white nationalists, blaming many sides for the violence.
But the very dishonest media, those people right up there with all the cameras. And I mean truly dishonest people in the media and the fake media. They make up stories. They have no sources in many cases. They say a source says there is no such thing. But they don't report the facts. Just like they don't want to report that I spoke out forcefully against hatred, bigotry, and violence, and strongly condemned the neo-Nazis, the white supremacists, and the KKK.
And today, as workers in Charlottesville shroud a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee in black as a way of symbolizing the city's mourning for 32-year-old Heather Heyer killed after a white nationalist rally, this after a city council voted Tuesday morning to drape the Lee statue and another of Confederate General Thomas Stonewall Jackson at another nearby park. But out of step, Donald Trump last night continued to complain about the move across the nation to take down monuments and sculptures which speak of hate.
They're trying to take away our culture, they're trying to take away our history. And our weak leaders, they do it overnight. These things have been there for 150 years, for 100 years. You go back to a university and it's gone. Weak, weak people.
And Donald Trump promised the Arizona audience he'd create jobs. He gave himself a pat on the back for pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, and he moved on to trade and NAFTA, the trade deal negotiated between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico 23 years ago, which brought the three nations together as a single market.
One of the worst deals that anybody in history has ever entered into. We have begun formal renegotiation with Mexico and Canada on NAFTA. And I must be honest, and I've been talking about NAFTA for a long time, and I'm sorry it's taken 6 months, but we have to give notice. You have to see this. We have to give notice. And after the notice is given, you have to wait a long time. Then you have to give another, then you have to wait a long time. Anyway, we started 2 days ago, Bob Lighthizer. Personally, I don't think we can make a deal because we have been so badly taken advantage of. They have made such great deals, both of the countries, but in particular Mexico, that I don't think we can make a deal. So I think we'll end up probably terminating NAFTA at some point. Okay, probably. But I told you from the first day, we will renegotiate NAFTA or we will terminate NAFTA. I personally don't think you can make a deal without a termination, but we're going to see what happens, okay? You're in good hands, I can tell you.
Not such good hands, according to Bill Warren. He's senior trade analyst with Friends of the Earth. He says NAFTA was one of the first really dangerous trade agreements. Before it, trade agreements were about trading, about goods and services, but NAFTA sought to limit government's ability to regulate in the public interest. While Donald Trump says he wants to make a deal on NAFTA to benefit workers, Friends of the Earth is very concerned he's renegotiating to benefit corporations and to remove more of these safeguards which are already in place.
We're very, very concerned. I mean, we've carefully studied the official negotiating goals of Trump's NAFTA redo, and it's an across-the-board attack on public health, climate, environmental regulation. And of course, this is totally in line with everything else that he's doing as president. I mean, he's unleashed Scott Pruitt, a climate change denier, at the head of the EPA, who's put together a deregulation task force to emasculate that agency. He's pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and he's a threat to the environment every day of the week, and it's clearly his plan to use this NAFTA renegotiation to hobble the capacity of Canada, the United States, and Mexico to protect the climate, protect the environment, protect public health with sensible regulatory safeguards.
Mm-hmm. And what about Wilbur Ross? What's your take on him, the Commerce Secretary, and the possible use of some of the TPP provisions in this NAFTA renegotiation? Can you kind of talk to us a little bit about Wilbur Ross and what is going on here with the TPP?
Wilbur Ross is a fabulously wealthy billionaire takeover artist, a bit of a pirate in the private sector. He takes over companies and breaks them up and sells them in pieces to make a profit. And so he comes at these trade agreements from that kind of sort of swashbuckling capitalist take no prisoners point of view. Mm-hmm. And he's made it very clear in public statements that he wants to incorporate provisions of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement into the new NAFTA. And this is despite the fact that that Trump and his presidential campaign demonized the Trans-Pacific Partnership as much as he did NAFTA. So I think he's a very dangerous fellow, although I don't think he's really totally up to speed on trade policy, but they have a U.S. trade representative named Bob Lighthizer, who's a very accomplished trade lawyer. So I think that the planet is in peril.
So speak about these TPP provisions that they might try to resurrect, which would undercut some of the environmental protections which have been set up for years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, these agreements are very very technical, and they're written in trade law jargon that's indecipherable to the layperson. But there's a chapter on what they call technical barriers to trade, which is gobbledygook for rolling back chemical regulation, pesticide regulation,
stuff that's harmful to the health of all the people on the planet, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, if you talk about chemicals, we're talking about regulations that are intended to protect the public from dangerous chemicals that are associated with breast cancer, with autism, with infertility, and many other illnesses. And this is the stuff he wants to roll back and deregulate. That's really frightening.
And so Friends of the Earth has put forth some of what you would like to see in the renegotiation. You don't want to see NAFTA renegotiated in secret. What are some of the other things that you're interested in as this goes on?
Well, in terms of a positive agenda, we would like to see the protections for the planet as well as protections for Wall Street, or in the place of protections for Wall Street and giant global corporations. So we'd like to see an enforceable environment chapter in NAFTA so that we could effectively enforce our domestic environmental safeguards, especially those related to agriculture, food, chemicals, biotechnology, and climate. And we want that these environmental safeguards to be enforceable by international tribunals in the same way that Wall Street investors and big corporations are able to go to these international courts and checkmate domestic actions. So Trump's not going to agree to that, but we just want to make sure we have a positive message of what a good trade agreement would look like. And, you know, it's not that we're opposed to all trade agreements. We're just opposed to an agreement. It's not so much about trade as it is undermining the capacity of democratic institutions to protect the planet and to protect regular people.
And so is it concerning to you that the Trump administration is trying to renegotiate NAFTA in their way to benefit corporations and then use it as a template for other pacts with other countries?
That's exactly right. I mean, don't get me wrong. NAFTA and other existing trade deals need to be renegotiated so that they're fair to people and fair to the planet and preserve our democratic institutions. But Trump is seeking to renegotiate NAFTA and renegotiate other old trade agreements and negotiate new trade agreements that go just in the opposite direction. I mean, he pretends to be a champion for the little guy, and he's sometimes pretty persuasive for people who feel like they've been ignored, as they have been. But if you dig into the details, you can see that he's just a scam artist. He's, you know, he's insincere, and he's not looking out for industrial workers or the little guy in these trade deal renegotiations. He's looking out for his buddies like Wilbur Ross, swashbuckling billionaires and get-rich-quick artists and big corporations on Wall Street. Those are the ones who win. This is exactly the wrong way to go.
And so finally, for listeners, for WBAI listeners to kind of stay woke regarding this whole renegotiation of NAFTA, what would you suggest? What do you suggest?
Well, I think it's very important for people in the New York area to talk to their members of Congress and make sure that they not only take the right position, but that they're very zealous in fighting this, you know, and not only get the vote initiative, if it ever come to a vote, but to, for them to put pressure on the White House, go to the press, sound the alarms to the people, because it's only people power that can checkmate this gambit of Trump's.
Bill Warren is senior trade analyst with Friends of the Earth. The first round of negotiations between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico ended over the weekend in Washington. Mexico will host the next round in the first week of September. Countries are saying they are optimistic about the possibility of reaching a deal. And you're listening to the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio. This is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Turning to local news, this week a coalition of citizens, attorneys, and elected officials rallied outside the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse. They called attention to an aspect of New York's criminal law they say is in dire need of reform. They claim that New York's prosecutors are using a decades-old rule to extract plea bargains from innocent New Yorkers. Matt Patterson has the story.
Imagine you've been charged with a crime you know for a fact you did not commit. Do you think you would ever plead guilty? You might not expect it, but the answer to that question likely depends on what state or even borough is trying your case.
If you're charged with a crime in New York State and you go into court, your lawyer, despite the lawyer's best efforts, filing motions to ask for the disclosure of the evidence, the law says to a district attorney, you don't have to turn it over until the last minute. And often that is the eve of trial or during a trial.
Tina Longo is the attorney in charge of criminal practice at the Legal Aid Society, the largest public defender program in the United States. She says that the discovery rules in New York leave defendants to gamble with their lives as they weigh their options before trial. A law that critics call the blindfold law allows prosecutors to withhold evidence from the defense until right before trial, but only in criminal cases.
In a civil matter, when it's banks or property, you get full, robust discovery. The opposing side has to turn over stuff, and when they don't, the judge sanctions, and you lose the right to some of your pleas. So the end result of that is, if you hold these up side by side, if property and money is at issue, well, we have full transparency and fairness. But if you're locked up in a 6x6 cell, charged with a crime, you get nothing.
Decades ago, many states operated similarly to New York. But in recent years, states nationwide have changed their policies, and New York is one of the last to reform. If your case were tried in New Jersey, the law requires that discovery be provided before a guilty plea is even allowed. The Legal Aid Society alleges that Manhattan's district attorney provides less evidence than DAs in 46 other states. Without access to the prosecution's evidence, defendants and their lawyers have no way to know how strong the case against them may be. They have to decide whether to take a plea bargain well in advance of their trial. Waiting for trial means spending more time and money on preparation for a court case, and the possibility of a much harsher sentence if they are found guilty. It also means waiting in jail if the defendant cannot post bail. More than 35,000 people in New York City are jailed each year because they cannot make bail, and nearly 80% of the inmates at Rikers Island are being detained pre-trial.
We should never, ever, as a city, as a state, as a nation, barter due process and justice for efficiency, and that has to stop. We do really have to look at why this system is 99% pleas, or 98 in the state system of pleas, and those are pleas without people really knowing what evidence is against them or not against them.
We had to put up a $100,000 bail to keep him from staying in jail until the trial was going. And since we did not take a plea, that trial took 2 years. Many people cannot afford that kind of bail money. And their loved one, their child, their daughter has to stay in jail. Now, I can't imagine my son having to stay in jail for 2 years before that trial even came up. But this happens. This happens all the time.
Jim and Annette Lockhart experienced the detrimental effects of New York's antiquated disclosure rules when their son, Torian Lockhart, was charged with a robbery they knew for certain he did not commit. After 2 years waiting for trial, their son was found not guilty. In a civil case after the criminal trial, they learned just how weak the prosecutor's evidence had been all along.
There were 17 adjournments that they made, okay, within those 2 years. And when they made those adjournments, they had nothing. We found out once we did go to trial that they had no evidence. They had an empty envelope. And throughout that, they were talking about plea bargaining, but they had nothing on him. Their evidence that they had really would have exonerated my son.
To be clear, prosecutors are supposed to turn over evidence that is favorable to the defense. A 1963 Supreme Court ruling requires them to do so, but the reality is that the court never set deadlines for those revelations, and the prosecution determines which evidence qualifies. The argument for keeping the current disclosure rule is that it protects witnesses and encourages citizens to come to the police when they have evidence. Because so many cases are resolved by plea bargain, the names of witnesses who have come forward in those investigations are never publicly revealed. But there are other mechanisms for protecting witnesses. Judges can issue protective orders of various kinds on a case-by-case basis. The Brooklyn District Attorney decided to voluntarily commit to open file discovery 30 years ago. If you're charged with a crime in Brooklyn, you'll have access to the evidence against you well before you would in the other four boroughs. The new interim DA recently went on the record saying that they would continue that policy, and has seen no public safety issue under that policy. While it's true that the rest of the city could follow Brooklyn's lead at any time, advocates for criminal justice reform don't want to leave that decision up to each district attorney. Instead, they are pushing to change the law in Albany. A new assembly bill would require prosecutors to automatically turn over police reports, witness names and statements, and grand jury testimony early in a case. The New York City Council has passed a resolution in support of such a bill, and the bill has received an endorsement from the New York State Bar Association. The courts are also considering reform. and may soon adopt a proposal that would allow judges to hold prosecutors in contempt if they knowingly withhold favorable evidence. Tina Longo is hopeful that, one way or another, the disclosure laws will soon change in the city.
It forces people to make decisions that will affect the rest of their life. And when we look at the long-term effect of that, it is no wonder that so many New Yorkers are walking around with a criminal conviction. They are disenfranchised from jobs and housing. And frankly, with a criminal conviction, there's no way to restart your life.
Matt Patterson, WBAI News, New York.
In other news, the Associated Press is reporting the ACLU is facing an angry backlash for defending white supremacists' right to march in Charlottesville. It's confronting a feeling among some of its members that was once considered heresy. Maybe some speech isn't worth defending. Cracks in the ACLU's strict defense of the First Amendment, no matter how offensive the speech, opened from the moment a counter-protester was killed during the rally in Virginia. Some critics said the ACLU has blood on its hands for persuading a judge to let the August 12th march go forward. An ACLU leader in Virginia resigned, tweeting, "What's legal and what's right are sometimes different." "This was a real tragedy, and we're all reeling," said Lee Rowland, a senior staff attorney at the ACLU's headquarters in New York City, saying Charlottesville should be a wake-up call to all of us. Rowland said, "If people are gathering armed to the hilt and hoping for violence, I think the ACLU would be doing damage to our free speech rights in the long term." The newfound limit on how far the nearly century-old ACLU is willing to go to defend free speech sets up intriguing choices in the months ahead. Will it intervene, for example, in the case of a white nationalist rally at Texas A&M that the university canceled after Charlottesville? The ACLU said it won't discuss when and where it might take a stand. Seeds of upheaval in Charlottesville were planted when a judge agreed with the ACLU that white nationalists should be able to protest the removal of the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee where the monument stands instead of a neutral site sought by city officials. It was a position consistent with the ACLU's history of defending free speech rights for protesters on all parts of the spectrum. But then James Alex Field Jr. was accused of using his car to kill 32-year-old Heather Heyer and injure several others who were staging a counter-demonstration. Within hours, a board member of the ACLU's Virginia branch resigned and fired off a stinging tweet that ended with, "I won't be a fig leaf for the Nazis." In an opinion piece in the New York Times, Kesu Park, a race studies fellow at the UCLA School of Law, argued that the ACLU's defend in all cases approach to the First Amendment perpetuates a misguided theory that all radical views are equal. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe went further. He accused the ACLU of creating a powder keg in Charlottesville. The ACLU of Virginia responded by saying it was horrified by the violence but didn't cause it. "We don't support Nazis," it said. "We support the Constitution and the laws of the United States." The latest criticism of the ACLU has come from some of the same people who had heaped praise and donations on the organizations for its resistance to Donald Trump's travel ban. Membership surged from 25,000 to 1.6 million, with $90 million in online contributions. That's in the months since Trump's election. Civil rights attorney Ron Kuby said the ACLU has faced much worse before and emerged stronger and more dynamic. "Refusing to represent people who intend to march while visibly armed is a reasonable line to draw, given what we've seen from the white supremacists." And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, August 23rd, 2017. The news was produced with Matt Patterson and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Bye. with the gun.